following is a presentation of Learfield IMG College. From the Georgia Southern Sports Network, powered by Learfield IMG College.
Wake up, Eagle Nation! Touchdown, Georgia Southern!
This is Inside Eagle Nation, your all-access look into Eagle athletics.
Taking a look through all the other action in Georgia Southern athletics this past week. A lot of road action. A lot of teams hitting the old I-16 out of town.
Getting on the steel horse and taking us to parts north, south, west, wherever. Can't really go too much farther east.
Now let's return to the Learfield IMG College studios. Here are your hosts, Colin Lacey and Danny Reed.
That's a fact, Jack.
Welcome into another edition of Inside Eagle Nation. Colin Lacey alongside Danny Reed as we continue right along with another week in Georgia Southern Athletics. Got a victory for Georgia Southern football this past weekend over the Trojans of Troy on homecoming. We'll dive into that in a little bit later in this week's edition of Inside Eagle Nation. But for now, remind you that, as always, Inside Eagle Nation is presented by our good friends at Arcola Septic. Arcola Septic is your premier septic services provider to Bullock, Bryan, and adjoining counties, and a great family-owned business that's run by a pair of Georgia Southern alumni. Make sure to give them a call at 912-318-7939. Or visit them online at arcolaseptic.com. For both commercial and residential customers, their more than 10 years of experience can help you out with pumping and servicing your septic system, drain field repairs, new system installation, and all of your septic needs. Remember to follow them on Facebook, Arcola Septic, yesterday's Meals on Wheels. A fun homecoming in Eagle Nation this past week. Your favorite thing about homecoming, Danny Reed?
I think I've said something to this effect before, but even though there couldn't be 20,000 or whatever fans inside Paulson Stadium, and I'm sure the crowd in the tailgate lot was a little bit reduced as well, it still felt fairly close to what we ordinarily see. You get to see people you hadn't seen in a while. You still get that feeling inside Paulson, whether it's 25,000, 20,000, 12,000, 5,000, 3,000. It has that feel that nobody can replicate in this league, especially once Georgia Southern got the offense rolling in the third quarter, thanks to someone we knew about, but we didn't know what he could really do until asked to do it. They're always memorable because you put the homecoming label on it, but the fact that I think that we were able to play homecoming is still that victory, and I know that we talked about this last week, and it's come up several times during the fall already, but the more you're able to do, considering what everybody's going through, and look at the news from the last few days coming out of the SEC, multiple games getting called off. I think we're over 40 games that have been altered this season because of COVID-19. So the more that we can do, the better that the Sun Belt looks. And considering that the Sun Belt has already done so well on the field this year, they've been on national television more this year than any other year, the league continues to look good in a year where not a whole lot has gone right.
And it's not necessarily just on the field, because outside of a couple of snafus early in the season, the Sun Belt Conference, for the most part, hasn't had a whole lot of games called off. You think of a couple of non-conference games early in the season. I think Arkansas State and Memphis were one of those in week two or three. But outside of that, I know Georgia Southern and Appalachian State had to be postponed until later in the season. But outside of the Appalachian State couple of weeks where they had to shut everything down, there haven't been a whole lot of issues in the Sun Belt.
They had to do two things. Number one, they had to proceed as close to normal as possible, considering the protocols that were going to be put in place. And, yeah, the Sun Belt had to wait and see what a number of Power 5 leagues were going to do. And we remember later on in the summer, whenever it seemed that the Big 12 had the key to the season, whenever the Big 12 said they were going to go, then the ACC said yes, the SEC said yes. Soon after, the Sun Belt and Conference USA and the American said that they were going to go through with it. And then the second part was, okay, you were going to get hit by it at some point. It was just a matter of how you were going to deal with it. And for the most part, for a majority of what has happened, the 10 member institutions of this league have done a really, really good job of negotiating through all of this.
And everybody sees the games that are canceled. And it's one of those that a lot of times you see what went wrong, but don't see everything that went right. And so you see a game gets canceled and you're like, oh, well, you didn't necessarily do everything you should, when that's not necessarily the case. And you look at how much has been done in this league this year, I think really speaks volumes to not only the conference but the member institutions.
And, yeah, we're going to focus on football, but when you bring in the Olympic sport, you also remember that the Sun Belt does have 12 teams. You bring in UT Arlington. You bring in Little Rock. There have been issues. You were naive to think that you were going to get through an entire season without at least getting bit a little bit by COVID-19. And at Georgia Southern, it wasn't just football that experienced a little sell, if you want to call it that. Volleyball was down for a couple of weeks. Women's soccer was affected. But the fact that we were able to see the right people do right, deal with it, get better from it, move on, gets us now to approaching the second week of November. And yeah, I know we're barely halfway through what is a football season, and basketball is fast approaching, winter sports are fast approaching. You've got baseball that's going to be right around the corner. We don't know when they're going to start. You hope it's going to be sometime in February like they typically do, but you simply have to value each day you get to do whatever it is you get to do.
You look at a kind of 100,000-foot view, and the conference has already completed two seasons. You had the women's soccer championship wrapping up last week as South Alabama took the title. You had the cross-country championships the week prior to that. And so you've got two teams for Georgia Southern that have started their season, gone through their season, and finished their season all with minimal problems, which I think is something to really kind of tip your hat to.
And then the league is sitting there in New Orleans just exhaling after each day, after each week, and especially when you could say a season got completed. That's a major thing. Now, will next year, will things be back to normal? Who knows? We'd like to think they will be. But the fact that you can get through it now gives you contingency plans for if you have to deal with it again, and it has a set of protocols already built in, so you can be even better if this happens to still be the case once we get to 21.
Couple of seasons still going on and a couple of getting started, as you mentioned, with baseball coming up in February. Men's and women's basketball going to be starting in a couple of weeks. But for now, men's soccer finished up their regular season as they fell 3-0 to Coastal Carolina at home this past Friday. They will start the tournament on this coming Friday up in Atlanta as they will face the number one seed Coastal Carolina team once again. That'll be a 4:00 kickoff up from Atlanta. Georgia Southern Women's Golf up in Macon yesterday and today, if you're listening to this on time on Tuesday. They'll finish up the Mercer Invitational up in the Mid-State at the Brickyard Golf Course. Georgia Southern Women's Rifle will host the Georgia Collegiate Championship on Sunday as Georgia Military College and North Georgia will make their way to Statesboro in an event that's closed to the public. But again, you can watch it on the Twitch feed. You signed up for your Twitch yet?
We're going Twitch again?
Yeah, we're Twitching.
I haven't had the pleasure of signing up for Twitch yet.
We'll get it going.
Okay.
Georgia Southern Volleyball had a tough weekend up in Conway, South Carolina. Got swept 3-0 in three straight matches up in the Grand Strand as the Chanticleers took one on Thursday and two on Friday. They look to bounce back as they return home to take on Troy Thursday at 11 a.m. and 6 p.m. and then wrap up that three-game set at 11 a.m. on Friday inside Hanner Fieldhouse.
And there's no shame to losing to Coastal. That team is undefeated. And
yes,
they have one of, if not the best, volleyball programs in the Sun Belt. These are growing experiences. And for a team that I'm still thinking is trying to get physically right and mentally right to get through whatever part of the season they can, but they return home. And at some point, you feel like it's going to click for them. They had to go through this already. You would just think at some point they're going to be able to play the kind of volleyball that they want to.
Yeah, this is one of those programs that, and we've talked with Coach Willis about it, the results on paper may not be showing up quite yet, but it's trending in the right direction. And before long, you're going to see those W's fall in that win column for them.
And I could argue that's the same case for Texas State football, which we're going to talk about in our final segment. But just be prepared for a similar conversation regarding that.
But again, you got three games coming up this week inside Hanner Fieldhouse. Make sure to come on out to Hanner and support this program, one of the up-and-coming programs on this campus. Can't get too far without, I'm not going to call it a retraction, but it's more of an apology.
Oh, what did we boo-boo?
Well, you didn't necessarily do it, at least not publicly. But Georgia Southern Baseball with the Fall World Series this past week, going to be finishing up in the next day or so. But the series has already been decided. You had the Ducks and the Pirates.
Okay.
The Ducks led by Jason Richmond and Colin Murray. You had the Pirates led by Lawson Humphreys and new volunteer assistant, who we're going to talk to in just a few minutes, and Seth Lancaster, former Coastal Carolina Chanticleer that saw the light and came to Statesboro.
Of course.
But
matter of time.
Aaron Soka and I had both said that we were going with the Pirates. Had so much defense on that squad. But Jason Richmond and the Ducks came out and swept the first three. Again, they're going to be finishing up that five-game series in the next day. But we called the Pirates, and the Ducks came out and just put our nose in it.
You know I was going to pick the Pirates, regardless of who was on the roster, because I made this joke to Lawson Humphreys that this may be the only time I get to see the Pirates participate in a World Series while I'm alive. So I thanked him for that. I was there for a little bit of game one, a little bit of game two, so I didn't get a chance to see the theatrics. And I know Christian Avant had a walk-off home run to win game three. The Fall World Series is always fun, and across the country, you don't hear a ton about them, sometimes in the SEC. But the thing that's always fun about it is what they play for. And mm-hmm. the tradition in Statesboro is, at least under head coach Rodney Hennon, that the winning team eats steak, the losing team eats hot dogs. So in a way, they both win. But in another way, the Ducks really came out on top.
Oh, yeah. No doubt. But
quack, quack. I told him I would do it. Quack, quack.
There you go. The best part about it was about 3 minutes after the final out, or I guess the walk-off home run by Christian Avant in Game 3 that sealed the deal, Jason Richmond texted you, Aaron, and myself, and all said, don't doubt the Ducks.
Yes, he did.
And I think we're on his list right now, but we got to bring him some high chews to make him feel a little bit better.
Yeah, a couple of days of high chews and he'll forget all about it.
But they will finish up the fall portion of their schedule in the next day or so. They'll get the steaks and the hot dogs grilled and then look ahead to 2021 for Georgia Southern baseball. A lot of really good things along the horizon. Getting to see some new faces for Georgia Southern baseball. Getting to see guys like Corey Dowdell, who's a freshman coming in, who has one of the most raw power swings that Georgia Southern's seen in a little while. And, yes, that includes Ryan Cleveland.
Yes.
But there's also guys on the mound. You look at a Dolander. So many guys that are new to this program to complement the nucleus that you've already got.
Yeah, Chase Dolander is somebody that's quite possibly going to be in that weekend rotation once 2021 gets here. He's going to be involved in some way, shape, or form with guys like Tyler Owens and Jordan Jackson coming back. It should give the Eagles one of the best rotations and one of the best pitching staffs for sure in the Sun Belt. And then somebody like Jalen Payton, a two-way guy who can play anywhere in the infield. He can also pitch. He doesn't look like he has power, but he had a couple of home runs in the Fall World Series. There's a lot to like about him. He is quickly moving up the list.
Without a doubt. But that'll wrap up the This Week in Georgia Southern Athletics portion as we take a look back to Georgia Southern football taking on the Trojans of Troy. Talked about it last week, the high octane, what Terry Harvin kept calling the fast break offense for the Trojans. But
just can't get him off basketball.
No, and it made sense because there's a couple of Troy programs across their athletics that like to go up-tempo. You think of Troy women's basketball that likes to score about 150 points every game.
Well, you know the story behind Troy men's basketball. When Don Maestri was there, they have the NCAA record for scoring in a single game.
I believe it.
Because they used to be, I mean, we see fast break offenses now. They used to be the preeminent source of fast break basketball. They were playing DeVry, I think. I can't even remember if it was 91 or 92, but they scored 250 some points in one game.
No, thank you.
there's a story about it online somewhere where they had to have a team of nine statisticians go through everything after the game was over to make sure that everything was correct. Yeah. And that's all by hand. There's no stats crew. There's no fancy schmancy stat broadcast like we have now either.
No, thank you.
Yeah, I'm good.
They probably ran out of paper.
Yeah.
Run out of room on your paper. But you've got Georgia Southern and Troy this past Saturday, and while it was homecoming, everything going around the game, you really liked what you saw really from the word go from Georgia Southern, in the fact that control of the ball is something that we talked about last week was going to be a huge key for this team, because if you gave Troy the ball, let them have their tempo, let them get in their rhythm, it probably wasn't going to be a great day. Georgia Southern, especially in the first half, had a couple of 10-minute drives, 10-plus minute drives that really kept Troy off their rhythm. And we talked about how much they're a first-half team and just really could never get it going.
It was a team win because the offense, even though they only scored 20 points, by holding the football for 42 minutes and 47 seconds, that immediately meant that Troy wasn't going to be able to do what it did to Georgia Southern last year at Veterans Memorial Stadium when they scored 49 points. They had the ball for almost 25 minutes in the first half. Eagles only run about 60 plays per game. They ran 43 plays just in the first half. Troy only ran 20. Part of the reason was because of reason number two. Georgia Southern's defense was fantastic on Saturday. 5-3 and outs forced. Second straight game, they forced 5-3 and outs. And we were expecting all this tempo from Troy, and there were a couple of drives where they got into it, but their fast break is predicated on completing passes. When they kept going incomplete early and getting into second and third and long, they couldn't do what they wanted to do. That's why they shredded Georgia Southern last year, because Caleb Barker, it seemed that he couldn't miss. So they kept the clock going. They didn't sub. You couldn't sub. And they went right down the field and did whatever they wanted to. Saturday, they couldn't hook up on intermediate routes. They couldn't get their running game going. They didn't even try to in the first half. They had two rushing attempts before halftime. And part of it is because they just didn't have the football. What hurt a little bit is that the offense only scored 6 points off of those two long drives, one of them nearly 11 minutes, longest since Georgia Southern had an almost 13-minute drive against Troy 5 years before, when 18 plays. But the fact that the offense could simply stay on the field was how that they were able to go ahead eventually, because it was cumulative. It wasn't necessarily that in the first half it was going to give Georgia Southern points. It could have, but it didn't. And Troy was leading at the half. They led 13-6 in the third quarter. But it all started to catch up. The big play kicked in. Gerald Green stepped in for a 69-yard touchdown run. Why was Gerald Green in the game? Well, that's because J.D. King and Wesley Kennedy were both knocked out. And for Kennedy, the news appears to be much better. He's probably good for this weekend against Texas State. The news on J.D. King isn't. And all we can do is just hope for the best with him, because it doesn't look like he's going to be playing football for Georgia Southern again this year.
Talking with Coach Lunsford at the press conference earlier on Monday, kind of gave a little bit of clarity on those two, said that J.D. King is going to be having an MRI this week, and the results of that are kind of going to determine what the outcome is for him. You're looking at more than likely not going to have him against Texas State at very least, and then moving forward, it's a matter of what the results on the test say. But for Wesley Kennedy, mentioned it that it's a tooth injury. His tooth kind of got jammed. He saw a dentist earlier on this week, and everything looks to be A-okay for Kennedy going forward. But it was another injury that really kind of set the game on its tilt, too, when you found out 90 minutes before Jacob Free was going to be starting. Gunnar Watson was not going to play for Troy. Saw him in street clothes on the sideline. And we had talked about last week how Jacob Free came in against Arkansas State and just dominated with over 400 yards of passing. But he was one that couldn't get in the rhythm either. You saw a couple of times where receivers gave up on routes, a couple of times where he just missed receivers. And it was something that he ended up with just over 200 yards of passing on the game, which doesn't sound awful. But a lot of that was the last drive of the game. And you never felt like he was comfortable, and a lot of that was Georgia Southern getting as much pressure on him as they did.
Yeah, there was only one sack, but they hit him 10 times. That's the most quarterback hits that the Eagles have posted this year. They also broke up 9 passes. Derek Canteen had himself an All-American kind of game with 2 picks, both of them in the second half, and his one late in the fourth quarter helped seal the game. So he has 4 interceptions now, and there's history behind this, because he leads the country now with 4 picks. He's not tied with anybody. He's number 1 in the country with 4 picks. First Eagle freshman to have that many interceptions since 1998, same year that the last time a freshman had a 2-interception game that happened against Appalachian State. Thank you, Arky Thompson. they had to get a stop when it was necessary, and that's why it was a team win. Because the offense put Georgia Southern ahead. Shy Wirtz's go-ahead touchdown run towards the end of the third quarter finished up what was an outstanding quarter on the ground when the Eagles averaged better than 10 yards per carry. Then they went quiet a little bit. They had four straight drives with no points. You had a field goal try coming this direction as we record this in the Bishop Fieldhouse that could have been for a two-score game. Ends up not going the Eagles' way. And the drive that Troy put together, it was their best drive of the game in terms of getting into their pace, their rhythm. Free started that drive 5 out of 5, and then he missed 4 of his last 5, including the tip ball that resulted in the interception for Canteen. And that's the defense, again, having to step up. Game-winning play against Campbell. Game-winning play against ULM. Game-winning play against South Alabama. Keep in mind that this is the fifth time the Eagles have played a one-score game this year. They're 4-1 in those games. So for as much flack as the offense is supposedly getting for not being explosive enough and not scoring enough, the Eagles are 5-2 right now, and there's a lot of teams in this country that would kill to be 5-2.
We've talked about it a lot, and I know I've talked about it probably ad nauseum, but a close game against Campbell, a close game against Louisiana, all of these close games that was it what Georgia Southern was hoping for or expecting? No. But at the end of the day, if you don't have those, I don't know that you necessarily are in the same position that you are in, because if you don't have Derek Canteen, Anthony Wilson getting the experience and the two-minute defense like we've talked about so much against Campbell, against Louisiana, I don't know that they're as prepared as they were against Troy, and you may see Troy go down and march down, score a touchdown, and you may be talking about something completely different on Saturday.
And that goes back to our weekly visits with Scott Sloan. It's not so much that these guys couldn't show their talent, but getting into those situations and being able to mentally process what is going on and do it quickly. Now, Troy was trying to go tempo the entire game. We've covered that already. So they're already in their minds thinking, okay, call's coming in. I got to know what I'm supposed to do, and I've got to be able to do it very quickly, because if I'm thinking too much, the ball's going to get snapped. I'm forgetting what I'm supposed to do, and then I'm giving up a long play. Wilson has improved immensely just this year. Coach Sloan has told us how much of a stride he has made since last offseason. Canteen is becoming a star. Yeah, he's only a redshirt freshman. He's becoming a star, and if he can stay humble, I think he's got a chance to be really good, and he's been compared the last 2 weekends by Coach Lunsford to Kendall Vildor. Not necessarily that he's the same kind of player, but the work ethic is there. He's very businesslike. He comes in, he does his work, he wants to improve, he wants to be the best at his craft. Getting Kendrick Duncan back has been an unmistakable addition to that secondary. And I think about the pass breakup that he had when he was pretty much falling back first into the ground on a post. I think McLean had gotten behind the third level, but Duncan jumped up with supreme athleticism to knock it away. Next play, free goes deep for Trey Eford. Daryl Baker swoops in from the other hash to knock that ball away. Now the Eagles going to deal with adversity? And there were a couple of other things. The second touchdown drive, there was a holding penalty on that first play of the drive. And typically for the offense, that has meant that you're donezo. Beck, get ready. Come on. You're going to be out here in a couple plays. Eagles end up going downfield to score because in part of an inhuman catch made by Najee Thompson. One-handed grab where I think every part of his body was being held except his left hand, which he somehow held out, and the ball ended up going into it. And even he had to bounce back from adversity because he had the kick catch interference earlier on that half, which gave Troy possession in Georgia Southern territory. Troy didn't do anything with that. They had first and goal at the 4, got down to the 1, ended up kicking a field goal to only make it 13-6. So everything kind of worked together, and you can say all you want to. Georgia Southern didn't score enough. They weren't convincing enough. What am I doing? Why am I here? It's got to get off all that. The Eagles are figuring out ways to win. The offense is going to do what it needs to do when it needs to do it. And look at Shy Wirtz. Shy probably wasn't at his best for a majority of the game, but he completed 12 out of 13 passes. It was relatively low risk outside of the ball that Najee caught there in the third quarter. And 12 out of 13 ends up being 92%, second best in Georgia Southern history. Ends up with 50 yards rushing, but he didn't have to do it. He didn't have to take control statistically. He had to keep the offense calm. When Kennedy went out, when King went out, people are looking around. What do we do? Old QB1 says, look, we good. I got this. I've started 41 times in my career. I've been through it. I'm not going to give you all the yards, but I'm going to lead this offense, and we're going to score. We're going to score when we have to, and we're going to win this game.
It's exactly what they did as a 20-13 victory for Georgia Southern over the Trojans of Troy on homecoming. But now it's time to look ahead to the Texas State Bobcats. Come in with not the record they would want at 1-8, but nonetheless, this is a Texas State Bobcats team that is definitely on the uphill climb. We'll dive into them a little bit later on in this week's edition of Inside Eagle Nation, but for now, we step aside for some Eagle Tales with Roger Inman.
Time now for Eagle Tales with Danny Reed and Roger Inman.
Roger, last few years, it's been popular for teams, when they get ready to go into a tough environment, to put crowd noise in over the loudspeaker to get an idea of what it might be like to play there. But 30, 35 years ago, how did Georgia Southern deal with that?
Third game of that year, we went to Northern Iowa. That week for practice, Coach Russell had me get a hold of Nate Hurst and get a crowd noise tape that he had put together. Carried speakers out to the practice fields, put them around the field, just made as much noise as we could make. Then brought them on that Thursday practice, brought it indoors. Practice in Hannah with as loud as we could get the volume so you couldn't hear. The reality is when you got up there in their dome, you couldn't hear. When they were quiet, similar to North Dakota's dome, you know, when their spectators were quiet, you could hear yourself think. But when they didn't want to be quiet, you didn't hear anything in it. You couldn't hear a pin being made, much less drop. It was so loud in that place.
Good stuff, Roger. Now let's go to Colin Lacey with this week's Beyond the Bio.
Time now for Beyond the Bio with Colin Lacey.
So we continue on this week's edition of Inside Eagle Nation, stepping to Beyond the Bio over at J.I. Clemens Stadium with the new volunteer assistant coach for Georgia Southern Baseball and Seth Lancaster. Seth, appreciate you joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Now, just getting to Statesboro in the last couple of weeks, what's it been like your first couple of weeks in Statesboro?
I absolutely love it. This is my first ever coaching position, first ever chance being able to, you know, really share my knowledge, or what I think is my knowledge, you know, just trying to remember what my coach has taught me and just trying to help these guys out as much as I can. And I think the main thing right now is just trying to learn all the names. So once we can get past the names, I'm sure we'll be all right.
Now, your name will sound familiar to Eagle Nation playing at Coastal Carolina, but take us back into your story a little bit. When did baseball become something that you really loved?
As long as I could remember. My mom tells me stories when I was in the yard when I was 3 or 4. She was trying to turn me around and make me hit right-handed. And then by the time she would get back to throw to me, I'd already be turned around left-handed. So really since I was, you know, probably 3 or 4 like any other kid, just trying to figure out what I enjoy and just kind of stuck with it throughout elementary school, middle school, obviously all the way until pro ball. So I was just, you know, lucky enough and caught some breaks, and I was just really blessed to be able to have a passion for the game and, you know, have a good work ethic and trust in that stuff. And it took me to some really cool places and gave me some really cool stories.
Again, we talked about you playing at Coastal Carolina, graduated in 2018, but you were part of that 2016 College World Series team. What was that like, and what was that experience?
It was one of the greatest experiences of, you know, my baseball career, and I'll have those friendships for the rest of my life. I have a lot of faith in that, and just I still talk to a lot of those guys every day. With the release of on social media of me getting this job, you know, guys from, I could name off probably 10 or 15 guys from that team that shot me a text, a couple guys called me. And the really cool thing about that team that we always talk about, and it's, you know, kind of the main focus when any of us talk about that team, is just the relationships we built. And, you know, every conversation I had with any of those guys, it was ended with an I love you and I love you too, you know. And that just kind of, that's what made us special. You know, obviously we had the talent and obviously we were a good ball club, but we were just, you know, so bought into each other and we trusted in each other. And, you know, that's something I'm trying to pass on to, you know, anybody that I come in contact with now as a coach. And but it's definitely something I hold dear to my heart, and I know each and every one of those guys do too.
One of the things, playing at Coastal Carolina, you got the opportunity to play under Gary Gilmore, the head coach for the Chanticleers. He's one of the guys that around the entire baseball world, people know the name Gary Gilmore and what he brings to that program. program, being able to play under him and learn under him. Now it's you're moving into the coaching side of it. What are some of the things that you take from him?
Just really coming to work every day and having a standard. You know, he set a standard from day one with us. You know, we kept that standard until the last day I was there. And it's a standard of excellence. It's a standard of winning. It's not all the time spoken on, but coming into practice every day, especially on game days, you know, it's expected. We're expected to win. We're expected to take care of who we are as a team, and whoever's in the other dugout is really irrelevant at that point. You know, we're playing the game against ourselves. The game of baseball is hard enough. So just really trying to focus on what we can control. And again, that standard he set of winning and professionalism and being selfless and being relentless. And at the end of the day, being a good young man and turning into a good man before, you know, turning into a good baseball player. And I think that translates, you know, to basically every guy that I've played with, from Coastal, everybody I've ever met. You know, it's just being a good person and you know, caring about the guy next to you, and that carries on to the field.
After you finish up your time in Conway, get drafted in the 8th round by the Phillies, play a couple of years in the Phillies organization, being in pro ball and being at the next level, what does that really teach you and now being able to use it as your coach?
Just really how much sacrifice you have to put in, how much time do you have to put in off the field. Not only do you have to get your extra work in the cage and, you know, do everything you're supposed to do in the weight room, it's a lot of nutrition, it's a lot of sleep, you know, being able to recover and play, you know, 14 days in a row, have a 10-day road trip. You know, you gotta take care of your body, because that's our tool. You know, my dad's a carpenter, so his tools are in his toolbox, and he takes care of those. But, you know, we as baseball players have to take care of our bodies. And just really being exposed to, you know, 10-day road trips, you know, one off day a month, you know, having to show up to the field every day with the right mindset mainly, but, you know, also having to, you know, have your body feel good enough to, you know, play another 9 at 7 o'clock, you know, and that's very important. And in college, you have more off days. You know, you play 3 games a week on the weekends and maybe 1 midweek. So that just gives these guys more time to recover, and it should give them, you know, more of an edge because they have that extra time. But just really focusing on taking care of your own body, taking care of your own, you know, mental state, being good mentally, and just kind of evening everything out.
You talk about that this is your first official coaching job in college athletics. When did you decide that coaching was something that you wanted to do?
I've always wanted to be a coach ever since I was in elementary school, but I wanted to be a history teacher and a high school baseball coach. But about halfway through my college career, I realized school wasn't really what I enjoyed as much as I used to. Obviously, it's important, and you know, I have a degree, and I'm very happy about that. I'm very proud about that. But I knew I was very passionate about baseball, so the next step up from that was, you know, coaching college baseball and being able to impact guys' lives and, you know, see them grow up from freshmen to seniors. Like I always heard from Coach Gilmore, Coach Snall, Coach Schill, just being able to see guys grow up and mature. I'm really looking forward to, you know, get my first taste of that and just see guys grow and, you know, help them off the field as much as I could help them on the field.
You make your transition now to Statesboro, but you've known Georgia Southern baseball for the last couple of years, being at Coastal Carolina, playing Georgia Southern a couple of times in your career. From a player standpoint, what was your opinion and mindset of Georgia Southern from the outside looking in?
They were very, very similar to us at Coastal Carolina. They take pride in being blue-collar, you know, maybe not necessarily the most talented team you'll ever play, but, you know, they're going to play hard. They're going to play the game the right way. They're going to take care of the baseball. They're going to pitch well. You know, it's going to be a dogfight. Like I said, we might not be the most talented, but then you have to put a chip on your shoulder and really play hard and play smarter than the next guy, because you can't rely on your talent. So a lot of things are very similar. And then even being here now on the other side, seeing from the coaching side, the practices are very similar. The head coaches are very similar. They're kind of wired the same way. They act the same way. And, you know, it's the same thing, you know, bringing that winning mentality, you know, building a culture throughout a program, and Coach Hinn has done a great job of that, and that's very comparable to what Gilly's done over at Coastal. So it's been kind of an easy transition, you know, being familiar with them as a player and then the two programs being so similar.
One of the best parts about being around the baseball world is the people that you get to meet. Who are some of the people that have really impacted your life, not only as a baseball player and now as a baseball coach, but also personally?
The entire staff at Coastal Carolina, I can't thank those guys enough. Me and, you know, Coach Schilling were probably the closest out of that entire staff. But, I mean, even Coach Thomas is the pitching coach. Every time I talk to those guys, just like talking to my former teammates, you know, at the end of the conversation, it's an I love you. And, you know, it's a meaningful one. It's not just a, hey, you played here for 4 years and we appreciate what you did. I mean, those guys genuinely care for every single player that comes through there. And that shows, you know, every guy that leaves, you know, if they don't continue to play baseball, they're successful business people, they're successful business owners. You know, I think that's just that speaks for what kind of ship Coach Gilmore runs over there and the guys he surrounds himself with and that coaching staff. And I can't say a bad thing about those guys. Coach White, when he was there, Barry, he's still there. You know, that entire staff is just so caring, and you know, it's a really good environment to want to better yourself and to want to help your teammates and want to be selfless and want to be relentless. They help everybody out. That it's open door policy. That anything you need, you could talk to them. And then on top of that, they're some of the greatest baseball minds, you know, in the country. You know, we were just talking about Coach Gilmore. So I can't thank those guys enough for what they did for me in college. And then obviously my parents and my brother, you know, raising me the way they did, you know, that has a huge part to do with it. And it was very similar to how Coach Gilmore runs his program, you know, respect, you know, caring for one another, you know, loving one another, you know, all those, you know, cliche basics. But I think those are very important, not just for baseball, but, you know, for life.
Finally, before we let you go, this segment's called Beyond the Bio. Give us something that people seeing you around J.I. Clements may not know, something beyond your bio.
I think the only thing I could think of is I don't know how to swim. I really can't. Never could swim. I swim like a rock. But other than that, I'm just a pretty normal dude from Charleston, South Carolina.
Seth, appreciate the time. Appreciate everything that you're going to do for this baseball program, and we'll talk soon.
Yeah, man. Thank you for having me.
Again, that's Seth Lancaster, the new volunteer assistant coach for Georgia Southern Baseball, as Cody Wofford rides into the sunset, getting a full-time assistant job up in Kentucky. But congratulations not only to Woff for everything that he did here for Georgia Southern Baseball, was an instrumental part of the success for Eagle Baseball over the last couple of years, but now Seth Lancaster gets his first coaching job, and if he can coach half as good as he could hit, he gonna be all right.
I had a chance to meet him last week, and I think the second thing I said to him was, you know, the ball you hit here in the 2017 tournament still hasn't landed. You said, yeah, I got that one pretty good. Yeah, the blue monster didn't look so monstrous after he did against Texas State. He said, yeah, that weekend wasn't too fun for us, because remember, it became single elimination, and they were going in thinking that they needed a win.
That weekend wasn't a whole lot of fun for a lot of people.
No, and it did end fun for Georgia Southern, losing the championship at J.I. Clements. But, yeah, that was a Coastal team that had a lot of really good individual talent. Lancaster was part of it. But when it became single elimination, Coastal realized, well, we can't come out of the loser's bracket, and they probably needed at least a win or two to be eligible for the NCAA tournament that year. They had won the national championship the year before. Eagles went up to Conway and took 2 out of 3 in the first true series that the two had played against each other in the Sun Belt. But even with that, I think Texas State was the 8 seed, ended up with the upset, and then that's who Georgia Southern played the next day.
That was a fired-up Brant Freeman and Bill Culhane that night.
Yeah, a little bit. And then they got ahead. They got ahead in the first inning. I think Teddy Hoffman hit a 2-run home run. But Brian Eichhorn came in out of the bullpen, shut him down over the next 6 innings or so. Logan Baldwin had 4 hits. He tore everything up that tournament. Ryan Cleveland tied the game with a home run off of Cam Baird. A lot of that week was a lot of fun. Now, Sunday wasn't, but that's a nice memory, and nice that Seth could be part of that. And we welcome him, and we, again, congratulations to Woff. He's such a great job here. He's going to do awesome things up at Eastern Kentucky.
Georgia Southern football looks ahead to the Texas State Bobcats, who come into Allen E. Paulson Stadium this weekend. Again, their record 1-8, 1-4 in Sun Belt Conference play. But this is a team, we've talked about it really since the beginning of the season, that Texas State's going to be a lot better this year. It hasn't necessarily worked out into wins as of yet for this Texas State team, but this is for sure a team that's on an upward trajectory.
I'll say this once. This is not the time to start thinking about West Point.
No.
I'm going to be very blunt about that. There's talent on this team. They have just been plagued by injuries in their secondary. They've struggled with depth because Coach Spavadal has had to turn over the roster. 50% of the guys are new, whether that's freshmen, sophomores, or going the transfer route. He has 9 P5 transfers, and they litter. They're too deep. But even then, they play so many guys, it's almost not needing a two deep. It's just needing a roster because they play that many guys on both sides. But I'm just telling you now, they're waiting for a landmark victory. And I think in their minds, they believe that it was at ULM. That's their only win this season. Went to Malone Stadium, ripped up the Warhawks 38-17. And the best way to avoid adversity is just to not to deal with it, because they got up by two scores, held a two-score lead for most of the game, ended up with a three-score win when their cornerback, Jaron Morris, had a 100-yard pick six in the final seconds. Call him Baby J, by the way.
Good for them.
Yeah. But they haven't won since. They've lost their last six. Schedule-wise, could have beaten SMU to start the season. SMU was a 10-win team last year. They had them in San Marcos. I think it was a winnable game, but plagued by consistency, and they had multiple guys out because of COVID. They should have beaten UTSA. Ended up going to double overtime. They lost by three. Jeremiah Haydell, one of their standout receivers, and we'll get to more personnel in a moment. He had a punt return touchdown with about a minute left to tie the game. All they needed was an extra point to go ahead. Missed. In the second overtime, missed a 20-yard field goal. UTSA wins the game. Most importantly, this team should have beaten Boston College.
Yeah.
They led them for almost the entire game, only trailed for 3 seconds. And those were the final 3 seconds after BC kicked a game-winning field goal to win 24-21.
You and I were listening to that game on the way home from somewhere.
Yes. From ULM, actually.
That's right.
And they're looking for that win. Another win. Because this is a program that is doing the right things. Jake Spavadal is the right guy for this job. Despite being the second youngest head coach in the country, they are doing the right things. The offense is a mile ahead of where it was just 2 years ago. They have doubled their rushing production since last year when they were one of the worst rushing teams in Sun Belt Conference history. And defensively, they've given up 36 points per game. But they began the year with 13 healthy defensive backs. They're down to five. And they play five DBs in their base defense. Do a little bit of math. They don't have any depth.
That math I can do.
Yes.
Not well, but I can do it. When you dive into the personnel for this team, starting on the offensive side, have played two quarterbacks pretty consistently throughout the season. You look at Brady McBride transferring from Memphis after 2018 for the redshirt sophomore. But the guy that, against Appalachian State this past week, really kind of took over, and from early indications, he is who we kind of expect to see starting the game against Georgia Southern on Saturday, is Tyler Vitt, the junior out of San Antonio, a guy that seems to fit more with this offense.
And if you think 2 years ago when these two teams last met in San Marcos, Vitt was the starter. He's made 15 career starts. He's capable, but like McBride, struggles with consistency. He's not near the running threat that McBride is. McBride's got a little bit of Johnny Manziel in him, but he's been very erratic. Five interceptions his last two games, so that's why they made this QB change. I think Vitt gives them the best chance to win because he doesn't make nearly as many mistakes. He is a game manager that can do more than what is required of a game manager because they've got explosive talent at receiver. I mentioned already Jeremiah Haydell. He had that huge game against ULM, had a 75-yard touchdown reception, and we already talked about the punt return against UTSA. Jamari A. Shareed is a tough matchup in the slot. He only goes about 5'7", but I wouldn't overlook him because he's going to go by you. Javen Banks had a 75-yard touchdown catch last week against App State that put him up 7-0. The guy, though, that is their best receiver, at least in my opinion, and he's the best receiver in the league that nobody talks about, it's Marcel Barbee.
Yeah.
Has 8 touchdowns. That's third most in the country. He's tied with Ark State's Jonathan Adams, and he's also tied with Alabama's Devontae Smith. He's caught a touchdown in each of the last 3 games, and some of the catches he makes, like the Najee Thompson catch against Troy, it seems as if there's at least one a game where he just does something that you can't really explain. Had a catch like that against Boston College, had a one-handed catch against App that's going to go down in the stats as just a catch, but it was on the sidelines. He just reached up like Spider-Man. Dude, how did you do that? But he's real deal.
The thing that really impresses me about Barbee in the little bit of film and looking at the stats, he's not a guy that gets all the numbers based off of home run balls. He's a guy that, yeah, he's averaging 14, 15 yards a catch, but the longest one he had is under 40. The longest one he's had this year is 39 yards. And so it's not like everything that he's getting on these 8 touchdowns, almost 400 receiving yards on the season, it's not like it's all home run balls. It's doing it consistently throughout the game.
Now, he's taken advantage of catching passes that other people don't. And yeah, he does have some drop issues on more catchable balls, kind of like an Odell Beckham, and you could even put Najee Thompson in that class, and I think that Najee would admit that because he makes some of the most insane plays we've ever seen at practice, but then some of the other ones that could have been easier to catch just don't go his way. For Barbie, though, that 39-yarder you bring up, that ball wasn't even in his neighborhood. He was against ULM. He was going up against their All-American, Corey Strotter. He was falling down. Strotter batted it, and Barbie had his head towards the ground, and somehow the ball got to his hands. I've watched it about 100 times. I don't know how he caught the ball, because he wasn't looking at it. He wasn't trying to look at it. But those are the kinds of plays that he has made, and that's why I think he has taken over as their number one receiver. They've tried to move Haydell a little bit to the slot. He was on the outside, but Spavadal trying to move him to the slot to at least get him more involved in the passing game because he's been slowed a little bit. I think teams have keyed on him, and consequently that's given Barbie more of a chance to show out. If you're Georgia Southern secondary, last week was a tough challenge. Just because Texas State's 1-8, don't think this isn't going to be a challenge. I'm just telling you.
You talk about the improvement they've made on the rushing side of the ball the last couple of years. The two that you're really going to see running the ball for this team, Brock Sturges and Calvin Hill. Sturges, the sophomore, transferred in from Butler Community College with 5 touchdowns on the year, 3 touchdowns from Calvin Hill for the redshirt freshman out of right there in Texas. And those are two guys that, again, a lot like you talked about with the receiving core, really underrated in the league.
They ride a hot hand approach, and they did it last week, and I'm going to get to how that differs from what we could expect to see on Saturday. Sturges and Hill shared the carries against SMU in the opener. They both almost went for 100 yards. Hill had 100 even. Sturges was just under that, but he's had a couple 100-yard games already this season. Last week, you turn on the Appalachian State game thinking you're going to see 5 Sturges, 22 Hill. Well, it ends up being more of 28 Jamel Jeter, the transfer from Oklahoma State. He missed the first 3 games of the season because the NCAA hadn't dealt with his waiver yet, so he doesn't become eligible until that Boston College game. Since he's been activated, he's averaging better than 7 yards a carry. He went 11 for 135 against App, former teammates with J.D. King out in Stillwater before they both left with all the running back talent Mike Gundy has been able to recruit for the Cowboys. I do believe primarily it's going to be Sturges and Hill, but that's another instance with Jeter because he's finally in the rotation and he's capable with the game that he put up against an App State defense that doesn't give up much of anything to anybody except Georgia Southern. But I think that you're going to see a heavy dose of all 3 of them if Texas State's plan is to establish that run.
Flip it over to the defensive side for this Bobcat squad under second-year defensive coordinator Zach Spavadal.
Relation, yes, brothers.
Yeah. You don't have the name Spavadal without being relation. But you look up front, and the guy that on this defensive line that you're really going to have to key on if you're Georgia Southern is Nico Ezidor, a guy 9 tackles for loss already on the season, 30 and a half in his career. He's a guy that's really disrupted from the end position.
Yeah, he's good. He's 3rd in the league in tackles for loss, and he's having to be even more important now because, as we mentioned already, this is a Texas State defense that has dealt with a ridiculous amount of injuries, especially on the back end. They've had 3 guys get ejected this year for targeting, and their second-best defender, Gavin Graham, one of their linebackers, he's out for the year because of injury. So Ezidor's presence up front, it's good for them that he has been as noteworthy as he has. But keep in mind that in that offensive film room, you know Bob DeBess, Ron Hudson, they are looking at, okay, we have to stop 95. Yeah. That doesn't mean that anybody else isn't capable, but 95 has the numbers, so we have to make sure that we account for him every time we snap the football.
When you look at past the defensive line, there's a couple of guys that kind of stand out. And, again, this is a Texas State team. Again, I know they're 1-8, but a lot of guys that are putting up numbers that don't get a whole lot of – publicity around the Sun Belt. You look at Hal Vinson at the outside linebacker, 3.5 tackles for loss, 36 tackles on the year. Christian Taylor, the transfer in from Texas Tech. You talked about so many of the Power 5 transfers that come to San Marcos. He's got 4.5 tackles for loss. But a guy that we've touched on what Derek Canteen has been able to do in the secondary, a guy that is a little bit more experienced than Canteen but putting up similar numbers, is Jaron Morris. 3 interceptions on the year, also knocking down 45 tackles.
He is the only true corner that Texas State has healthy right now. Remember, they have technically five healthy defensive backs. They've had to play guys out of position. They've had multiple guys play both safety and corner, so you can understand giving up 36 points per game and 475 yards per contest. Morris simply being there has helped them be as good as they are. Without him, I don't know where that defense is. And it's not to the fault of the dearth of talent they have. They just don't have much depth because they've lost so much of it with COVID. They had an outbreak earlier on in the season, which they handled fairly well. And they just have lost so many guys because of season-ending injury. But Jaron Morris, we mentioned the pick six he had against ULM already. He had 9 tackles against App State. He gets more involved in the run game than a corner typically would. I think about the way Canteen gets involved in the run game, and I like that you made that comparison, because when we talked with Coach Sloan before, he has mentioned that Canteen isn't afraid to put his nose in and get his hands dirty. He's got 4 interceptions, but he's just as viable against the run as he is snatching footballs. But yeah, Jaron Morris, he's a good one.
One part of the alignment that we don't necessarily talk a whole lot about is the kicking game, but I think, and I know that kind of probably ticks Terry off, but this is one that I think you need to, because it's changed this year. This is a kicker in Seth Keller that took over in game 3 of the year against ULM. You talked about how in a game early in the season, it's one that Texas State probably should have won, but a missed extra point negated that. And then it's a change of kicker, and Seth Keller has come in 5 of 6 from field goal, 20 of 20 on extra point.
Yeah, he hit a career-long 42-yarder in the loss against App State. He was the special teams player of the week last week, because against Louisiana in a game that Texas State was in, they led 21-14 midway through the second quarter, but turnovers did them in, even though they forced 4. But he was special teams player of the week because he scored a touchdown. They tried to kick a field goal, ending up as a fake. Holder tossed over his head. Keller, a former high school skill position player, he was a wide receiver in Colleyville, Texas. He ends up running into the left of the end zone for a touchdown that got Texas State on the board. They scored 3 unanswered touchdowns. So I would think that's another thing that Georgia Southern has to be mindful of, not just that Keller can do it with his foot, but he can also do it with his legs, if that makes any sense, because no, he is a kicker. But
100%.
There you go.
We've talked about it the last couple of weeks that, to be completely honest and completely frank, and no, it's not us being frank, this is a Texas State team that in recent history hasn't had a whole lot to write home about. But being on the uphill trajectory, I think you see this team playing with more hunger than you really have the last couple of years. And I think a lot of it is because what we've talked about under second-year head coach Jake Spavinal.
He's legit. Look, he's a name, if you're a college football fan, you've heard for a while now because he's been renowned as a play-calling expert. He's been an assistant coach for Kevin Sumlin, who incidentally was an assistant coach with Bob DeBest when the two were in Minnesota many moons ago. Got to ask Bob about that. We'll get to him more in a moment because he, of course, ties into this. Sonny Dykeson, he was, of course, with Dana Holgorsen twice during his tenure with West Virginia. And it's not so much that he's just going to throw every time he gets the football, but he has this rep for developing quarterbacks, Kyler Murray, Johnny Manziel, in part of 10 guys that he's coached that have gone on to the NFL. He is the right person to be there. And yes, it's not weird that his brother, Zach, is the defensive coordinator, because during his 4 years at Texas Tech as a linebacker assistant, those were some of their best years in terms of forcing turnovers in school history. I think that they have pieces. But when you're trying to solve this Rubik's Cube, when you're trying to put the pieces together, sometimes you have a little puppy that comes in and chews up the pieces. Sometimes you have a child that comes in and steals the puzzle. And that's what they're dealing with injuries, with turnovers, with penalties. They had a second and 50 last week against App State. Second, I've never heard of a second and 50.
I'm going to guess that there's not a play on a play sheet on anybody's play sheet.
Funny thing is they almost got the first down three plays later. They got stopped on a fourth and five.
All right. Well, forget I said anything.
Well, they did. They were close. They did get it, though. But this is what they're dealing with. They haven't been good in league play. In fact, since they won seven games in 2014, they haven't won more than three in a season. And unfortunately, because in that 2014 season, bowl eligible, but that's when the Sunbelt only had three tie-ins and they didn't get invited. Got to give Bob DeBess his due real quick because he played at Southwest Texas State. He was a special teams guy and a linebacker under head coach Jim Wacker, G8 for him, and then he followed him to TCU in Minnesota. That's how he learned this game, and that's how he's adapted his version of the gun option over the last 40 or so years. Went back and was the head coach for Southwest Texas State from 97 through 02. And you know that every time we are down there for a non-football sport, we go into Strahan Arena, we find their Hall of Fame, we take his picture that's at least a number of years old from their Hall of Fame, send it to him, and I know he gets a kick out of it. That's where he met his wife.
Yeah.
Wife Janet was an athlete at Texas State, cheerleader in track and field. So this is meaningful despite being separated by more than 1,000 miles.
Congratulations to them, too. Have a new DeBess in the family.
Yeah, got a granddaughter born a couple of weeks ago. His son, Cam, is a wide receivers coach at Lamar. They had their second grandchild. And when we talked to him on Thursday, first question, how's the little? He was like, oh, we're fired up. Got a chance to spend about 5 hours with him after Southout. Then had to get right back to work.
Georgia Southern and Texas State. It's a 3:30 kickoff from Allen E. Paulson Stadium on Saturday. We'll get everything going as at least most of the band back together on Saturday. But a 1:30 airtime on the Georgia Southern Sports Network with the Eagle Tailgate Show. Before we wrap this one up, want to throw something new out there. And I haven't told you about this.
No, you definitely haven't. And you scare me when you do this.
That's part of the reason why I do it.
Go ahead.
But one thing that we've talked about a lot on these episodes of Inside Eagle Nation is how you can connect pretty much anybody in the sports world with anybody else in the sports world. So, our challenge, my challenge, is for people listening to come up with two people. Ideally, it would be some kind of connection to either Georgia Southern or somebody Georgia Southern's playing, and give us somebody else that we have to connect it to. So you give us two people in the sports world, can be random people, can be whatever, and we have to come up with the 6 degrees of separation for.
Could be anybody.
Can be anybody.
Okay.
Now, I'm not going to say if you send it in today, we're going to have it by next week. There's probably a couple of these that are going to take a minute because I know the creativity of Eagle Nation. But you can tweet them to us at GS Sports Network, text them to us, 912-274-3607, or any way that you can get them to us, do so. And
you got my gears a-clicking now.
Yeah, I can see the smoke coming out your ears, the wheels a-churning up top. And
Eddie to random athletes.
It doesn't have to be athletes. It can be coaches, can be support.
And it doesn't have to be related to Georgia Southern.
Doesn't have to be.
Okay.
I mean, ideally, most of them would be, but any two random people in sports.
Yeah, because we've talked before about it's mostly been a baseball thing, but especially in coaching across all sports, that you will likely find a connection between two coaches who have never met before. You will eventually find out how two of those coaches are connected.
Oh, there's no doubt. There's always a friend of a friend of a friend was his second cousin or something like that. But that's the new challenge for Eagle Nation.
Your 6 degrees of separation challenge.
Yes.
I like it. I dig it.
Send us any two names, and we will be tasked with finding the 6 degrees of separation.
Hopefully we'll have some of those before Ag Day on Saturday.
We'll do it.
Georgia Cotton Commission is going to be here. Georgia Peanut Commission.
Case IH Tidewater. A lot of good partners for Ag Day. We will dive into that more with the Friday night tailgate and on in to Saturday afternoon inside Allen E. Paulson Stadium. Again, 3:30 kickoff between Georgia Southern and Texas State. We'll hit the airwaves with the Eagle Tailgate Show at 1:30. For this week's edition of Inside Eagle Nation, for the voice of the Eagles, Danny Reed, this is Colin Lacey saying so long, everybody.
You've been listening to Inside Eagle Nation, powered by Learfield, the official podcast of Georgia Southern Athletics.